but yet has no silver cord been thrown away, nor golden bowl crushed, broken down, as they say. Not yet has the jar at the fountain been torn, the wheel at the wellspring is not badly worn. That is Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 6, from the Word Green version of 2004. Our daily scripture for today, little children. Now let's come and continue. By the way, I didn't go to bed last night. I want to talk about this. We're not really on a 24-hour cycle as humans. We're on a cycle. If you look at the, for example, what the Canadian military says is that the cycle, I'm not sure what you call it now, what the name of the cycle is. It's something to do with the human human activity or something. You know, it's something to do with the human cycle, the daily cycle. It's not 24 hours, okay? It's 25 hours, but if you do the calculation based on the moon, it's based on the moon, it's 25 hours. Because the moon is moving. We'll come back to this at the end if we have time. It's moving relative to the Earth, and it takes 29 days for the moon to get around again, so it's more than 1 hour per day at a rate of 29 days, right? It would be 24 hours. I mean, if it were 25 hours, it would be 1 hour different per day. That would take 24 days, and the moon would come right back to where it was. So it's more than 1 hour per day. It's something like 1 1/5 or 70-some minutes per day longer than 24 hours, our day. So every day I go to bed about an hour and some later. Or I try to. I try to go to bed at the same time, maybe, but I fail because we're not on that cycle. We're on the lunar cycle, right? So we're not on the cycle of the Earth's rotation. We're on the cycle of the Earth, Sun, Moon system. The circadian, that's what it is, possibly. The circadian rhythm, that might be what it's called. That's one name for some of the rhythms that we have, right? Circadian rhythms. So, and the military knows about it. You know, it's a well-known thing. We're not on a 24-hour cycle. So that's why after about, you know, every month, every month or so, I am able to just not go to bed that night based on that, right? Well, last night I didn't go to bed, but we'll see. You know, I don't feel like I needed, I didn't feel like I needed sleep. You know, that was the thing. Now, I do doze and nap during the day also, but that would probably be the case regardless. So we are in chapter, having finished chapter 2 now, of the Ark of Urartu. And I want to come back and explain how the Earth, well, the Earth rotates, right? Okay. It rotates from west to east because the sun rises in the east, right? So the Earth's rotating toward that. So if you look from the North Pole, the Earth rotates counterclockwise from west to east, so that the sun appears to be rising in the east. So then the moon, okay, prevents the Earth from completing its full 24-hour cycle. It makes it longer than 24 hours because the moon, by the time the Earth gets back to where it was after 24 hours, the moon has also gone counterclockwise and ran away. It's run away, that is. Run away. It's not ran. It has run. It runs, it ran, it has run. The moon has by that time run away from the Earth by an hour and about 72 minutes. An hour and some minutes, so that the Earth has to rotate more than 24 hours to get back to where the moon was, now is, where the moon now is. So the moon's rotation around the Earth, the orbit, is also counterclockwise, looking from the north, from above, or the celestial north, as we call it, right, if we're astronomers. So then, okay, so then the I think we can also say that the Earth's orbit around the sun is also counterclockwise, I believe. Everything is like that. Everything is counterclockwise, looking from the north. But you see how we can understand how things rotate and how they work just by understanding that difference between the 24-hour day and the day adjusted for the lunar calendar or the lunar cycles, the lunar rhythms. Now we're in chapter 3, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And in the map we saw, I don't know if I have the map here at the moment. There it is. Yeah, okay. We saw Japheth, Shem, and Ham, and Ham's in the southern hemisphere. Shem's in the middle latitudes, and Japheth is in the northern hemisphere. That's typical, and that's the way it turned out. You know, that's the way it was, which makes it relatively simple to understand, doesn't it? Now, the families of the earth were spread around after the deluge, as we see from where the families of Shem, Ham, and Japheth ended up. And that's point number one. Now, point number two, the events surrounding the Tower of Babel unfolded at the time of the development of writing. Very important to have that point, number two. Number three, the family of Cainan settled in what later became known as China, which is a very similar name to Cainan also. The two names, China and Cainan, are quite similar. If you just take the C-I-N-A, Kina, in Cainan's name, Kina, or if we pronounce it as a soft C, Jina. Jina is like China. It's almost exactly the same name. We have already seen how events surrounding Nimrod are tied to the time of Irish and Chinese languages creation. Right? Phineas Farsa in the Irish and Cainan in China. There are four lineages with four traditions, all of which correlate Armenian, Hebrew, Irish, and Chinese patriarchs. We looked at that table where we had the Armenian sons, the Irish sons next to them, and we had the Chinese, and we also had the Bible patriarchs, and we had the sons of Ham also. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, actually, if we include, or when we include the Chinese. Well, what have we got there? It's Noah's son, Yu Chao, right. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So why did I say 4? Let's keep reading here. Well, I guess we don't have a very good tradition in the lineage of Ham. I suppose that's what it is. We don't have a solid enough basis for saying we have a fifth tradition there. Why is that, if we look at that table? Well, sure we do. We've got the traditions. It's the Assyrian kingdom and so on, right? It's the Assyrian empire that came down through after Tower of Babel, the Akkadian empire, then the Babylonian, or the Assyrian, rather. Yeah, first of all, the Akkadian, then the Assyrian, and then Babylonian later on. So I don't know why I said 4 and not 5, but certainly if we've got 4, we've got 5. I mean, if we've got 5, we've got 4, rather. You know, we've got at least 4. So why did I omit the mention of the other tradition? I don't know why. Perhaps because they were somewhat portrayed as enemies in the Bible. I'm not sure why I didn't mention them, but perhaps we don't have a strong tradition from them either. That's possible. We don't have a strong language tradition perhaps from them, if their culture died out. That's what it was. Remember, Babylon was destroyed and the culture died out, and we lost that tradition entirely. We didn't lose the Hebrew, didn't lose Armenian, the Chinese, or the Irish. So there are 4, not 5. Every other scheme more or less diminishes these strikingly corroborative circumstances and consequently encumbers the subject with difficulties. That's from Sacred Annals by George Smith, Volume 1, The Patriarchal Age, page 320, 1854. The significance of this point is no less than the ability to bring events of this ancient time into a dated history. We have the dating of the dating of the genealogy, which is what we call our chronology, to guide us in this. It's like a genealogy too. It has a lot of genealogy in it, so that's why it's called the genealogy also for that reason. But every other scheme George Smith wrote about, he wasn't writing about our scheme, but he wrote about some scheme that he was concerned about and interested in. And he was, I'm using that as an illustration to describe our situation, that our scheme is the only one, or our map, or our understanding, rather, of it, is the only one that minimizes these encumbrances, you know, these difficulties. Many have tried to date these events, and we use that work, the blisteringly masterful work of Mr. William Hale, says, quote, according to the Armenian tradition recorded by Abel Faraghi, Noah distributed the habitable earth from north to south between his sons and gave to Ham the region of the blacks, to Shem the region of the tawny, Phascorum is the word, and to Japheth the region of the ruddy, Rubrorum. Page 9, it looks like that says, and he dates the actual division of the earth in the 100. This is not necessarily at all in agreement with ours, right? He's talking about Abel Faraghi. He dates the division of the earth in the 140th year of Peleg in BCE 2614, or as they used to call it, BC, or 541 years after the deluge. Now that we can use. We can say, okay, we can make it 541 years after the deluge in our chronology, which would be 541 years. Well, let's do it. This is how you can see where we get some of these numbers, too. When you see 3282 is the date of the deluge in our chronology, minus 541. In the BCE time period, 2741. That is what we call the dividing up, the time of the dividing up of the earth, 2741 BCE in our chronology. I've mentioned that date before. That's where it came from. This number of Abel Faraghi, which we preserved as being relatively correct, whereas his date for the deluge would have been different from ours. Okay? And also, he dated it as 191 years after the death of Noah. So if we add back 191 years, right, and then add, that was the death of Noah, then add the 950 years of Noah's lifetime, should get the birth of Noah, and we do, 3882. 600 years, when we take that and subtract 600, which was the age of Noah at the deluge, and we should get the date of the deluge when we do that, 3282. So it all is connected, and we just have chosen to use the number of Abel Faraghi there, 541. The point taken is 541 years after the deluge, using our 3282 BCE in the genealogy, bringing us to thus 2741, which is about 4 years before Fuxi's rule ended, which was 2737. That's what I'm saying there. we go back, we need to look at that table to see where the rule of Fuxi ended. It's a previous, earlier table. Here it is, I think. Yeah. Fuxi's rule ended right here in 2737. Right? That's the end of his rule. Okay. We're nearly done here, I think, aren't we? Oh, we've got a bit more to do. Mr. Jackson says that Peleg was born 531 years, but we have his date of birth based on our biblical, the Greek Septuagint account of when each son was born to each father, counting backwards to get to the birth of Peleg in 2749. That's what we have. So we have it as 533 years after the deluge. But also, so instead of 531, Mr. Jackson also gives the rule of Nimrod as ending 6 years after the dispersion, right? Now, the dispersion we have is in 2735. This now dates Hake killing Nimrod as 2735 in genealogy, our chronology. Where do we get that number from, 2735? Well, for one thing, in the Book of Sothis, Menes ruled for 35 years, right? That's one thing, which might have something to do with that. But wait a minute, now. Okay, so Nimrod ruled for 6 years after 2741. That's what it is. So when the land was divided up, that's when Nimrod began to rule in 2741. 6 years later is 2735. But that would be... this is 6 years. Okay. But we have the dispersion, though, in 2745, actually, in some of our other work. This is the very first time I wrote about this right here in this article. This is why it's an early version of it. But it's interesting, so we get 2735, killing Nimrod, if the dispersion happened in 2741. But the point taken for the 541 years was not the dispersion, was it? No, it was the dividing of the land, which wouldn't necessarily be the exact same as the time of the dispersion. Not necessarily. So we have to be careful. The lines of Shem, Ham, and Japheth corroborate this. I'm talking about 2735, along with the Chinese history as we have presented it in Table 2, which we already just looked at a moment ago. That was Table 2 right there. That's Table 1, sorry. So Table 2 is this other one that we just looked at yesterday, right here, yeah. Or the one that we've been looking at with the four traditions and five histories. Now, in previous articles, we have presented Joseph as having a family connected with the maritime god Poseidon, Neptune. Yeah, we actually consider Joseph as having been the mythological figure who was called Poseidon, because it means Lord of Own. The name Poseidon, when you translate that name, it was very hard to find the translation of the name Poseidon, but I finally determined it was Lord of On, and we know Joseph was appointed as the priest of On when he was appointed by Pharaoh to rule as the second in command of all Egypt. Now, Neptune is the Roman name for Poseidon, the Greek god, and gods Zeus... the family of Joseph is also connected with the god Zeus, who is also called Jupiter in Roman mythology. And that would be connected to, for example, Jupiter and Japheth have similar consonants. So there could be a connection there. And Hades, as well, is another god. And Reuben would be connected with Hades because Reuben did some bad things committed infidelity with the wife of his father. But the Roman Pluto is the corresponding god in the Roman mythology. Now, Mr. Hales makes a heathen fire of Noah and his three sons as follows. Cronus, the god of time, or Saturn. This is really good. Saturn corresponds to Jacob, actually, as well, in a very, very solid way in the chronology. But here he's talking about Noah and his three sons. Cronus, the god of time, or Saturn, divided the universe among his three sons, allotting the heaven to Jupiter, would be Japheth in the north, the sea to Neptune, would be the middle region, to Joseph, and, you know, the Semites, all of the Jews, and hell to Pluto, the south is what that means. The hell means the south, but also there's a kind of a, it's hot in the south too, isn't it? In the southern hemisphere, very hot in some of those lands. So that's why it's also analogous to hell. It's not really hell, but that's what Hale said. Hell was allotted to Pluto. So the lands of Earth were indeed divided, with Japheth in the cool northern climes, Shem in the mixed region of heat and cold, Shem that is, and Ham in the hot areas near the equator. That's from Book of Jubilees 8:30. I don't know if this link still works. Probably doesn't. No, they broke it. Someone broke the link. But that Book of Jubilees 8:30 would actually be the thing to look up there. We're not going to look that up today, I don't think. We've got to get busy with our video right now. So this is the Raw Expedition Part 2. We're on Part 2-3 now, from the 10-minute mark. See how this goes.
Among the birds was a ring-marked pigeon from Spain. We added another message to its foot. Stopped on the route 2, 21st of May. Refusing to return to land like the other birds, the dog chose to stay with us as a symbol of the multinational expedition right across the Atlantic Ocean.
Familiar birds from northern lands, like old friends to Heyerdahl, pay visits to Ra too. And so do more exotic birds from the tropics. They seem to think the bundle boat is their nest. Without wind, it seems pointless to keep on steering. So they leave the rudder oars to take care of themselves. Instead, they begin swimming to tidy up the reeds below, and Suryal, the frogman, uses his underwater camera. They make a disturbing discovery. With too little papyrus to carry too much cargo, more than half of the reed boat has been pressed below the surface. But as far as they can judge, the sinking appears to have stopped. Others arrive to make an inspection, including this grouper.
I was anxious myself to inspect the papyrus from underneath, and even more so the extremely thin rope which the Indians had insisted on using, claiming that the pressure would be evenly distributed along the continuous spiral. I found everything in perfect order.
Their floating aquarium includes a number of striped pilotfish, usually the hangers-on of sharks. they seem just as willing to attach themselves to Ra. Jellyfish and other members of that family drift by. In one area particularly polluted with oil, thousands of them are floating about, dead.
Even when we swam in clean water, small clots of oil often had to be brushed aside with our hands.
Safi the monkey is just as fed up with the drifting as anybody else. They even resort to rowing. As idle as a painted ship upon a painted ocean.
Finally, the wind returned, and we moved so fast that the lifebuoy had to be trailed behind on the rope as a safety precaution in case anybody fell overboard. It would be a last chance. We could not stop or turn back. We lived in intimate contact with the ocean. That is why we detected the pollution not visible from a big ship. From now on, all bathing had to be done inside a net. We were eight men from eight countries sleeping in the same basket. A Russian next to an American, an Arab from Egypt next to a Jew. There was ample fuel on board for a serious conflagration. Our paper boat was loaded with psychological... Yeah.
Well, we went over time a little bit, but that's okay. It's shocking how polluted the water was, even back in the days of that expedition, which began in 1969 and then resumed 10 months later the next year. I think it was, if it was exactly based on 10 months after April or May, whenever it was they set sail. I'm trying to think when they set sail. The reason I can't remember is because I've watched another video recently, which was the grandson of Thor Heyerdahl. And they set sail on the very same day on which the Kon-Tiki set sail from Peru. They built another raft and they sailed to Polynesia. This time they had a way of steering it. The raft was steered and they arrived successfully because they were able to steer it. So that was another, that's another movie. It's called, starts with T, I think, the letter T. Is it here maybe? Let's see, what have we got? What is it? The Ra Expedition 72. That's the other. Not sure what it is. Tuaranga or something. Tuaranga. It's something like Tuaranga. Tangaroa or something like that. I forget the name, actually, the precise name of the expedition. So coming back to, I wanted to talk about my burn a little bit. I remember, I don't think the ice is what caused the damage, because I remembered when I burned it, I was touching a very, very hot surface, and I didn't burn the tip of the finger, so that still has sensation, but I burned the pad. And when I burned it, I could feel the nerves being, destroyed. Like, I could feel that feeling. It was an intense feeling, so I think that's what destroyed the nerves. Now, maybe they can be regenerated. The thing is, the skin is sort of, it was kind of melted. The tissue was kind of destroyed also. So it's a pad where it's got very little pain there now, but if you destroy nerves, you end up with a little bit of, it's something like pain that you get when you rub it. Very mild pain. But it's only on the pad do I have that. So it's a disability. It's actually a disability that I have now. Associated with the burn and the nerve damage is a disability that prevents me from doing or being fully able-bodied. I'm not fully able-bodied because that part of my body is not functional, right? So that makes me disabled in that way, right? So, but the, everything can be seen as a blessing, right? A blessing in disguise. People sometimes talk about that idea. And why are some things blessings in disguise? I want to explain that. The reason is because you can see that if I hadn't had the injury, I wouldn't have had any reason to research and find out more about nerve damage and how to reverse it. But now, because I've had the injury, I can research nerve damage, how to try to reverse it, what things reverse it, how to help it. All these things that I have an opportunity, which I never would have thought of to do before, now I can do because of having the injury. Now, I never want that to happen again, so I can also use that as a learning experience of how we should all be aware that some surfaces don't look hot, but they are hot. I mean, if you touch them and they're hot, you can injure yourself. So I was actually trying to, close the valve after I soldered it, and I shouldn't have been doing that anyway. I was trying to close the valve with my finger, and it was a solid steel handle on the valve, right? It was a solid stainless steel handle that was super hot when I touched it, trying to pull it. I put some pressure on it, and that's, if I hadn't put the pressure on it, I don't think I would have gotten a serious burn. I must have put a little pressure, and that's why the burn went so deep in the pad. And I don't know if you're going to be able to, I don't think you'll be able to see it, but I doubt it. It's a very, very, let's maximize this. Let's try and get this bigger here so I can see, I can show you this. There, yeah. Yeah, there, maybe you can see. It's a shiny area there. It's duller in color. It's not normal tissue anymore. It's been modified by extreme heat. Not a good thing. I didn't show you, actually. Sorry about that. Just a minute. I didn't show you because I didn't transition. Let's see. Let's try again. We're a little bit over time. But it's not, on this kind of a camera, in this kind of lighting, you're not going to really see it as a major thing, but I can assure you it is a major disability as far as not being able to feel anything with that part of my finger. That's a pretty significant disability, I must say. And so, it's just one of those things that not having enough experience doing that kind of work, that happened, and it can be a blessing because I can learn all kinds of things from it about safety in all kinds of other ways, right? Plus, I get the benefit of trying to find out how to regenerate tissue or how to regenerate nerves. That is my quest now. You see, I get to try and find out how to do that in the future. I can try to research that and learn, find out how to do that somehow. So it's a blessing in that sense. I never would have had an interest in doing that, in regenerating anything, if I didn't have an injury like that. So I've had other injuries that are more or less, you know, scarring and things that are also fairly permanent, but they're not, you know, I had a broken fingertip that made the fingertip still a little bit tingly, very, very slight now. So I think, yeah, I think it probably will reduce over time too. This injury might completely heal with time. Possible. So I've looked up all the foods you can eat that help heal this type of nerve damage. I've looked it all up, you know, and it's an opportunity, right, to try and do that. So I'm following that course of trying to heal the injury. That's my life now that is enhanced in a way by having an opportunity to try to do something that could also help other people too, right? Definitely could help other people. If I could regenerate part of my body, that would be significant. So it's an opportunity. So it is today, that's the end of our study. It's September 27th, 2024 of the Common Era. And the time is 1849 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And thank you for listening and watching. In my behalf, this is Lib Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now. That was Chapter 3, Paragraph 1 of the article, The Ark of Urartu, The Orient Express.